Bow, bow. Bang, bang. Bench mob. Turn up.
It's the bench mob. Reggie, tat, tat. The bench mob.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Fringe Average Podcast with Jason Parks. I'm Mike Farron. This month, the Fringe Average Podcast is brought to you by Intrepid Inspections, bringing the same high-level thought and process to insurance inspections that Baseball Prospectus brings to baseball. Visit IntrepidInspections.com for our BP subscriber special. So you can go to IntrepidInspections.com for more information and check that stuff out. Great to have them on the show yet again this week. How are you? How's everything? Are you over your draft hangover?
I'm very well, thank you. I did a lot of like radio hits, and you know, I was on a lot of podcasts, and yeah, that started to die down a little bit. So my voice is coming back, but it was a pretty exciting weekend.
It was fun. I'm good. I mean, I've been immersed in honey-do lists and hanging out with the wife, and I leave for Omaha tomorrow. So for 8 days of the College World Series. So I'm excited about that, and was excited to watch the Super Regionals this weekend. I really do enjoy college baseball. I know it's a completely different level, really, than anything, even in the low minors of pro ball. But man, it's a lot of fun. There's a certain energy to it that you gotta love.
Yeah, I mean, actually, what's funny is that the energy is what turns me off.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, not the energy on the field. I don't like a lot of collegiate fans. You know, I don't like the rah-rah shit a lot.
I can see that.
So, I mean, but the play on the field, that's one thing. I mean, I don't like it. You know, I mean, some of it's a little league at times with, like, the chants and all that stuff, and I'm kind of over that. But it's when the people in the stands are doing it. And I know that, I mean, I'm in the minority here. I don't like that sort of participation. I'm not really into that. I just kind of want to, when I'm watching a college game, I want to watch the game. I don't want to, you know, get distracted by all the, you know, the 40-year-olds acting like they're back in college again.
Yeah, you know what? If you lived in Baton Rouge and you had seats down the left field line, I think you probably would have a different feeling about it.
I'm sure I would.
You know, I mean, if you're doing it for work, I get it. That's cool. But I mean, I think part of that atmosphere, the fact that they're willing to you know, tailgate for a baseball game, I think that's awesome. I think it brings a different feel to it. And you know, the thing is that Omaha has changed now because of the new ballpark. It's right downtown. They don't allow tailgating like they used to at Rosenblatt. So there's like a great street festival outside, you know, and lots of stuff. It's very family friendly. So, you know, there's lots of good stuff for the kids to do and things like that. But it's got a little bit more reserved feel inside, in part because the place is huge. The ballpark is enormous. Mm-hmm. And really, it has foul territory that looks at the Oakland Coliseum and goes, that's all you got? I mean, it is a real pitcher's ballpark. It's unbelievable.
Nice.
So, looking forward to getting there. And speaking of that, our music this week is actually from a group called Bench Mob. Now, Justin, who's one of our listeners, actually works as the opposition scout for Mississippi State. Mississippi State made it to the College World Series. They beat Virginia the other day to get there. And I promised him that if they made it, that I would play this song. So this is going to be our only song at the beginning and the end. But this is three members of the Mississippi State University baseball team trying to rap. So it's Evan and Ross Mitchell and Jacob Lindgren. And Lindgren's one of their top pitchers on that roster too, left-hander. But so they're that's what the music is, for better or for worse. No, it'll be fun. So I made a promise. I went out on a limb thinking, you know, maybe Virginia would keep Mississippi State out of the College World Series. But as a promise to Justin, we're playing that. So.
Awesome.
Deal with it. our email address for the podcast is fringeaverage@gmail.com. Best week of emails ever?
Like even going back to up and end times, I mean, I think that the crop that came in the last couple of days, and I mean like the last 5 days, were the best crop of email we've received on at any point, at any time during my podcast history, at least. I mean, there was just one after the other. It sucked. We picked 10. We could have picked 20.
Yeah.
I mean, they were that good. And it's not like they haven't been good in the past, because we've lauded them for it. But these were special. These were really, really thought-provoking. And, you know, I dug him. I dug him a lot.
Yeah, so it's great stuff. And, you know, this is the lifeblood of our podcast. So it's we're like PBS, except instead of donations, we just need you to give us emails. But please
and
keep
donations.
Sending them along. Well, and donations. We'll take the money, too, certainly. So, yeah, that's going to be a big bulk of it today as we're going to again, go through these great emails. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can follow the podcast at Fringe Average. You can follow Jason at Professor Parch. You can follow me at Mike Farron SXM. We have a Facebook group. Go to facebook.com/groups/Fringe Average Podcast to be part of the growing community there, almost 800 strong now. And lots of good participation, lots of good questions and answers and discussion that's going on there. I'm actually kind of excited at the way that's taken off. I try to participate every now and again when I get a chance, but some really great stuff on our Facebook page, too. I like the little community we're building. You guys are pretty cool, I got to say. I like.
You're all right.
All right. If you do or you don't use iTunes, please go there and rate and review us. For the simple reason, it makes it easier for people to find us, whether they are looking for us or they aren't. So just please go and rate and review us. And, you know, we like to have our egos fed as well. So or destroyed, depending on how you feel. My favorite is still the guy who hated me so much that he went and put up a review that was scathing and edited it 3 days later to add more. That's want.
It's probably Goldstein. He's probably all the negative reviews on the Fringe Average podcast.
Oh, I guarantee
you. You know he's reading them.
Oh, no, I know. I am sure he's listening, too, because, you know, why wouldn't he have anything better to do with his time at this point other than listen to and appear on podcasts?
Right.
So, all right. So to the emails. And again, fringeaverage@gmail.com. The first one. Here it says, Mike and Jason, I'm thinking about the Astros, there's an obvious huge level of rebuilding that's going on. I keep hearing from media types that Astros fans are upset, but of all my Astros fans, I find that we're unanimously encouraged by the steps that have been taken since the team sold. With that being said, I have a few questions for you. Feel free to answer one or all if you'd like. One, I had a debate with a friend of mine about what to do this year. I thought it would be best to emulate last year. The Astros have nearly $10 million to spend on their first three picks, 141 and 61, going 5% over slot. Cole Stewart went 4, and his draft slot is worth $4.5 million, so if he were taken 1-1 and signs for slot, which was as much as he figures again since nobody had him as a top three talent, that leaves almost $6 million for the next two picks. So they call Clint Frazier, whose slot is worth $3.7 million, and offer him $4 million, which is more than he could have gotten at the 5 on the condition that he refuses to play for anyone else and lets them know that. Now you have $1.3 million left for the third pick, which has the value of the 41st pick overall. So my question then was, if you're the Astros, would you really prefer Appel than Stewart and Frazier? I know that none of this is allowed to happen in the draft, but I also know that this type of stuff does, and everybody knows it. Two, it seems to me that when you're trying to totally overhaul a franchise, it would be good to first set a year in which you would like to really start producing big league talent on the field results. When you begin the process by taking Correa, you're shooting for 2015-2017. So that would lead me to believe that when you approach future drafts, you should do it with this time frame in mind. Next year, you have the beginnings of this come up. 2015-16, you have the majority of your guys scheduled to debut trying to be really good for 2017. This year, wouldn't it be best to push for 18-year-olds who would be seasoned on that time frame, then in 2014 and 15, focus on college guys who are close to ready? This way, all of your guys are going to hit their prime at the same time. I feel like this makes more sense than taking Appel 1-1 and having to fight free agency right at the point when you want to push possibly for a championship. Three, I know there's a huge jump from AA to the major leagues from the previous levels, but I never hear numbers associated with the transition. If Miguel Cabrera were in high A ball, what would his triple slash line look like? If Kershaw were in high A, what would his K per nine be? Thanks, guys. Matt and Baton Rouge. A lot to jump into here. So let's start at the beginning with the draft strategy and trying to steer someone to yourself later and whether or not that actually would work.
Well, it happens all the time. I mean, you know, no one's going to come out and just admit this. It's just one of the parts of the games. But pre-draft deals happen. You know, it's a very common thing. I mean, you know, you won't be surprised to learn that even some of the top guys in the draft have, you know, they know what they're going to receive, that the money has been discussed, and a lot of times there is that agreement in place. you know, as far as like this hypothetical of like you can get both Stewart and Frazier, well, that's not possible and that's not going to happen. So that's not even just we can't. It's not even worth talking about. You know, but you can, you know, go cheaper in the first pick and allocate funds later on. You know, much like the Astros, well, we'll stick with the Astros like they did last year when they went a little bit cheaper to get a guy like Correa that then freed up excess money or, you know, from the pool to sign guys like McCullers and Ruiz. And, you know, so that kind of stuff happens. The Royals were able to do it this year and they didn't get busted for it, you know, because Manaea was available for them. So they were able to go a little bit cheaper and underslot with a guy like Dozier and then be able to pop Manaea at what, number 34 or whatever. Right. So it worked out for them. But I mean, if you get cute like that, you can also lose the pick. You can also, the guy may not be there. You know, leaving talent on the board is very dangerous.
Well, and I think that's the biggest thing with this draft specifically is that there were three guys that were seen as having a really good chance of making an impact, and they were the guys that were taking 1, 2, and 3. You know, and I think that there was a clear separation between those three guys and the next bunch. Last year, I think you could make the argument that there were six guys at that time that seemed to be about the same. Now, in hindsight, Buxton certainly looks like he should have been the number one overall pick, right? I mean, based on what Buxton's done in A-ball, he should have been maybe every year's number one pick. But was that as clear? Was that as clear last year at the same time as it is now?
Yeah, let me you know, kind of channel my my inner Astro here. Even though I'm not an Astro fan, I do have a lot of friends in that front office, and you know, Buxton's a bad motherfucker. Let's just, I mean, he was the top talent in that draft. But, you know, Correa has impact potential. I mean, this is not a slouch player. This was not an overdraft. This was not a, you know, a reach. Correa is, you know, relatively speaking, he's a lot younger than Buxton. You know, Correa was a very, very young high school draftee, and that's important. He plays a premium position, at least for now. And he's, you know, he looks pretty good there. He has a very good feel for baseball. He has a very good, you know, body and, you know, physical projection. His tools have impact potential. He has a long way to go, but, you know, this is not a slouch. And to be able to go aggressive with him and then be able to pull in guys like McCullers, who is probably a late inning reliever in the end, and a guy like Ruiz, who had, you know, arguably one of the better prep bats in the class, you get, that's a lot of talent there. Now, if Correa develops, or, you know, even if Ruiz develops or McCullers develops, I mean, I don't think that they're going to sit back and go, oh, man, we passed up on Buxton, even though Buxton is bound to blossom into a superstar. I mean, the Astros did what they had to do to make their organization better. You know, one player, yes, that's a big step forward, but if you can, you know, get two or three major league players out of that, then that's an even bigger win for an organization that was in desperate need of, you know, of impact talent. They had a lot of depth, but they didn't have a lot of impact talent. So I think for the Astros, what they did in that draft was appropriate. Now, obviously, in this draft, which plays into a question now, is that, you know, they went a little bit more conservative. You know, they went a little safer. Last year, they went with Correa. They went with Ruiz. They went with McCullers. This year, they draft their first three draft picks for Friday starters, college Friday starters. You know, so you can tell that the strategy had shifted a little bit, that, you know, now it was time to get guys who can get up to the major league level within the next couple of years and actually help the major league squad get better, you know, as opposed to just building for this this abstract 2015-2016 time period.
Well, and I think when you start to look at windows like that, I mean, it goes, if you're building a good organization, it's not just about building so everybody comes up at the same time. It's about building depth. I mean, if you want to have sustained success, you need to have waves of talent. And so it always makes sense to take the best player that's available, or the player that you feel is the best player that's available, because you're always going to need depth. And depth, again, I mean, we've talked about this before. It manifests itself in different ways. It's either guys that are going to help your major league team, or guys who are going to help you acquire what you need for your major league team.
Exactly.
You know, if you have a deficiency in something that you're doing, you know, let's use, and we used this example last week, and it gets thrown around a lot, but let's use the Royals. The Royals have had a deficiency when it's come to developing starting pitching, but they've done a good job of trying to trade for starting pitching when they've needed it. They found, or at least this year they did. You know, no matter what you feel about Myers or what have you, they realized that what they were good at was developing guys who were seen as high end hitters. And they could get them for starting pitchers, which was the thing that they were having trouble developing. And then you hopefully are going back and analyzing your development plan to find out why it's not happening, if it's just the guys that you have, the makeup of the guys you have, or if it's something that you're doing at a teaching level. So I think there's a lot of different ways that it can be looked at, and it shouldn't just be that, you know, you're trying to get everybody to show up at the same time. You're trying to get a lot of guys to show up at the same time, but you're also trying to get a lot of people behind that so that when that first wave hits free agency, you have some replacement options. That's what the Cardinals are so good at.
Yeah, I mean, and also, if you bank on all these guys developing at the exact same time, making it to the major league level at the exact same time, you're really, like, missing the point that, you know, some players don't develop at all, mm-hmm. and some players take longer than others, and some blossom faster than others. So you can't really build on that philosophy. What you do is you just, as you said, you just acquire as much talent as possible, and it's all currency, and you spend accordingly, you know, whether it means trading your top, you know, trading from depth like the Royals did to acquire a position of weakness like they were able to do with the Shields-Davis deal, which I liked at the time and I like even more now.
Well, and it's always dangerous to put all your eggs in one basket. I mean, that's what it comes down to, too. And that's, you know, when it comes to development, too, if you're just going to shoot for one window, if you don't make that window, you're screwed. So the third one is the kind of fun part of the question, and we haven't gotten a lot of these on this podcast, but it's great. If Miguel Cabrera were in high A ball, what would his triple slash line look like? What would Kershaw's K-9 look like?
I mean, I actually think that what Cabrera would do would be even, you know, it would be pretty gross. I think that he would do some – I think pitchers would actually be so afraid of him that he would end up walking 60 or 70% of the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it would be like the best kid on a little league team, and you have to work around it. And if you make a mistake and come in, it's just he's going to hit it out. I mean, he's just going to crush you. So, yeah, I can. If you threw him a ball, he'd probably rarely get out, and then you would end up walking him the majority of the time. As far as Kershaw goes – man, you know it's going to be nasty, but, you know, I mean, if you've ever seen some of these major league pitchers that go back on rehab assignments, you know, there's always that, you know, fringe average dickhead who gets a home run off of a rehabbing starter.
Right.
And it's like they pimp it, and it's the story that they tell everybody for 10 years, and people hate them. I think that would happen. So I think, you know, Cabrera would be able to have a lot more you know, it would be nastier. I think his slash line would be ridiculous. Obviously, Kershaw could miss bats whenever he would want to, but, you know, somebody can stick the stick out, you know, every once in a while and make some contact. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think Kershaw's numbers would probably be pretty ridiculous, too, because I think he would have his way with his breaking pitch, especially the first three times through the league, you know. Cabrera, yeah, I mean, I think you have to account some bad luck into it for him, so he might only hit like 600.
But yeah, because he's going to hit line drives at somebody eventually.
But somebody's going to challenge him with fastballs, you know. And somebody's got a 7 fastball and A ball. You know, they're going to have a chance to get him out if they've got a little bit of an idea of what they're doing. You know, but putting a fastball in the right spot, or they happen to have good command that day, they might be able to get him out. I don't know that he's going to watch 60% of the time, but it might be 50, and. And the thing is that if I were him, I'd just be sitting off speed because the odds are overwhelming. You're going to get a lot of cement mixers, probably two in at bat. It's going to be ugly, ugly. I mean, yeah, I don't know. Is 500 saying he would hit 500? Is that too high?
I don't know if it's – maybe it's not high enough. You know, I think he would hit 500 at AAA. So –
I don't know if he'd hit 500 at AAA. 440, maybe. In the Pacific Coast League, he might hit 500. But
440.
our next email comes from Steve in New Albany, Indiana. And he says, Mike and Jason, my grandfather is an old fuck. He'd be perfectly fine with that description, who's been in and out of the hospital the past 3 months. It sucks to watch, but shit like this happens to us all. Hell, I'm 31 and was diagnosed with cancer at 27. Anyway, this 78-year-old man is the reason why I love baseball. He played professionally in the Giants and Dodger organizations, never making it to the show, but from hearing his stories, it sounded like a hell of a good time. He's not one of these bragging old bastards either. I had to read an article about him in our local paper one time to even know that he struck out Willie McCovey twice in an intra-squad game in spring training. That's fucking awesome. After injuries and life got in the way and forced him to leave the game, he eventually became a sports photographer. This turned out to be great for me growing up. I was basically raised in a AAA dugout. Since he played the game, they treated him not as some type of intruding media member, but as just one of the guys. Every summer, I'd spend all day having free run of the field in the clubhouse. This allowed me to experience a wide variety of shit that was absolutely awesome for a 12-year-old kid, such as the many uses of the word fuck, how to cuss in Spanish, coño, the porn mags in the bathroom stalls, taking BP with the team, then having the players tell me to get the fuck out of the cage, getting phone numbers from women in the stands, and my personal favorite, having to rummage through the clubhouse to find a calculator because the bullpen was trying to develop a mathematical equation to determine how many people in the United States could possibly be having sex at that very minute.
Man, there's nothing quite like talking to people who've sat in bullpens. I mean, they come up with the craziest shit.
There's a lot of free time out there. On a side note, this is why I would always chuckle when my baseball coaches who knew of my access would want me to tell my teammates how the guys on the bench were, quote, always into the game. It was great. And the time I didn't appreciate how special these moments were, as I've watched my grandfather's health fade, I find myself thinking of them more often, without making this too sentimental, but what I wouldn't give to have one of those days back again. So my question for you, gentlemen, is this. Who is the person in your life that baseball makes you think of? I can't separate my grandfather from the game. He always comes to mind. Did you have someone like that? Love the show, guys. I hope my email full of sentimental bullshit doesn't ruin it. I'm planning on attending the BP event in Cincinnati and would love to say hello. Steve in New Albany, Indiana. Steve, it's a beautiful email and great sentiments. And a beautiful story of him and his grandfather. Who is it for you that makes you think of baseball, or baseball makes you think of?
I've mentioned this before, but I mean, like, when for me, it's only one person. It was my mom. You know, she was the one who put a baseball in my hand when I was a kid. She was the one who taught me how to throw. She was the one who, you know, she coached my fucking t-ball team. You know, she drove me, you know, to practice my entire life. She drove me out of town games. She drove me across the state of Texas for when I was on travel teams. You know, that's when I think of baseball, I think of the person who taught me that, you know, that baseball is the sport. You know, they're the one that put the ball in my hand and said, this is what you are. You know, get used to it. It's going to be your life. And so that's the person I always think about when it's baseball. And, you know, she died when I was a kid, so she never got to see me work in baseball. So it's just kind of cool that I ended up working in baseball in some form, because I think that was, I mean, she put a ball in my hand when I was 3 years old, basically. And said, here, this is it. Go do it.
It looks like she had the right path in mind for you, so.
Well, I'm not sure. She made a lot of mistakes.
She may have gotten that one right.
Maybe. We'll see.
Or either that, or she screwed the entire baseball world over. Thanks so much.
I think she did.
It's tough for me. It's my mom's side of the family. My mom is the big, in my immediate family, my mom is the big baseball fan. Her two favorite players growing up were Minnie Minoso and Billy Williams. And she
Billy
loved
Williams.
Baseball.
All
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. She's Chicago as Chicago gets, but she was kind of a tomboy. And so she loved baseball. But I always think of her, and I think of my grandfather who used to mow the lawn listening to Cubs games on the radio. And that got me interested in it. And my uncle, who played on a softball team, who was the one who taught me how to field grounders and, you know, take batting practice and all of that. And that's my mom's brother. And it's very much a family affair for us, too. What's really funny is that my dad is not, you know, my dad coached my little league teams and stuff like that, but he's not nearly as into sports as my mom's side of the family was. And my mom is much more into baseball than my father is. My father is much more of an artist. So it really is. It's kind of cool that I think both of maybe that's why we get along, is because our moms kind of shared the game with us.
Yeah, probably.
So that's a great question. Thanks, Steve. The next one comes from Mark, who is in Lexington, Kentucky. He said, in last week's podcast, Mike referenced a scout school, which piqued my interest. As a 40-something baseball fan working in a soon-to-be-extinct industry, obviously not hardcore porn, I'm assuming it's newspapers, the idea of becoming a scout has often crossed my mind. Problem is, I have extremely limited experience in actually playing baseball and have no knowledge of baseball scouting other than what I've learned from websites like Baseball Prospectus and your podcasts. My question, then, is what is a scout school? What are the odds of a baseball fan with my lack of expertise actually becoming a scout? What is the life of a scout like? I'd especially like to hear what Jason has to say about this, since he's an expert in the area. Thanks again, guys, and enjoy the podcast, Mark. That's an actual Mark.
I'm not an expert, but I do have a lot of scout friends. I'm around them all the time. to, you know, to go back to his question, no, you're not going to become a scout, Mark. It's not going to happen for you.
Why you got to crush dreams like that, dude?
Because it's not going to happen for him. And I like Mark from Lexington, but it's not happening for him. You know, coming from a baseball background is a big edge when you to becoming a scout, whether you're a former player or a coach. Makes the transition a lot easier. If not, it requires an angle. You need to be able to offer something to a team that you know, that makes you stand out. I mean, luck is a part of it, and just eating and, you know, dying baseball 24/7. You know, and even people who have those sort of ambitions don't get the call. You know, that's why it helps to have a player, to have an in, or to do something that's interesting, or you know, just be, you know, really, really lucky. But yeah, you're probably not going to become a scout. As far as like scout school, a lot of teams who, you know, they sponsor people. Teams will sponsor people to go to scout school, and you know, not everybody needs to go to scout school. I mean, I've been around the scout school a bunch. You know, it takes place during the instructional league, so I've actually helped participate in some of the scout school activities out there, as far as like working with people, like helping them chart or teaching them how to use a radar gun or whatnot. But a lot of it is front office people or people with internships that clubs want to show, like maybe they do, you know, statistical analysis or even data entry or something. And teams want them to become familiar with every aspect of an organization. So you send them to scout school so that, you know, you can start to learn how to evaluate players too. It's a way of building like a well-rounded employee. Now you see a lot of former players, like right after they're done with the game, sometimes they go to scout school just to learn the details of, you know, of scouting, like, you know, charting or, you know, using the stopwatch or, you know, putting grades on things and whatnot. And you see some of those guys out there. I was out there a couple of years ago, and like Jock Jones was out there, and that was cool. And it's like he's standing with the class, and it's like, oh shit, look at this, look at this is, and that was really cool. But you know, and it's to the last part of the question, then I'll kick it to you. That what's the life of a scout like? Well, I know enough to be able to create a pretty decent image here. Is that it's not very glamorous. You know, these guys, it's not like, it's easy for me, like somebody who's not a scout, who's just, you know, an online talent evaluator. I get to put my, you know, my work online and like, you know, tweet it out and get the comments and, you know, either get, you know, shunned or patted or hit on the back, you know, and congratulated or whatever. The scouts, I mean, they send in their reports. There's no glory here. I mean, this is just their job, day in and day out, going to the field. And you know what? Here's the real thing. You know, when I write a scouting report on Byron Buxton or even, you know, Zunino or Cole or any of these guys are, I mean, it's not hard to write these reports, man. These are role 6, role 7, role 8 type of players. You know what's a hard report to write? The non-prospect. Mm-hmm. You know, when everything's a 3 and a 4 and maybe 1-5. That is difficult scouting. And that's what these guys do day in and day out with very little, you know, connection to the outside world. Living in their cars, living in really shitty motels, going from shitty place to shitty place, sending in reports that only a few people read and not always acknowledge. So, I mean, it's a very thankless profession, and that's what separates them from, you know, the people on my side of the aisle who get to write glowing reports about superstars and get all the accolades, where these are the people who are doing the real work.
And there's a ton of travel, too. I mean, I think that's the other part of it from the scout's life, is you are literally on the road the whole time. I mean, I know scouts that have been married for 25 and 30 years who barely ever see their families. And when I say barely ever, I mean it's, what, 9 months, would you say, is a fair guess? And you'd be 200-plus states on the road, 240?
And yeah, and the stretches can be pretty extreme, too. I mean, it also depends on what you're doing, whether you're a scout or whether you're, you know, the international scouts. I know an international cross-checker that is home 3 days a month. 3. A month, man. 3 days a month.
That's a lot of travel. And then
he's a 12-month on type of guy. There's no break for him.
Right, right. Does he do mostly Latin America, or is he doing...
He does all Latin America.
Okay, because the Pacific Rim guys, too. I mean, generally, those guys are living there for the most part, but you know, if you have to go to from the States over there, if you're an international cross checker, I mean, it's a lot of travel, and it's a lot of time away from your family, and it's a lot of, you guys used to talk about an up and in, it's a lot of shitting in McDonald's bathrooms. But if it's something that interests you, I won't be quite as negative as Jason is. Yes, you're probably never going to become a scout, but the best thing to do is to, you know, you live in Lexington, Kentucky. Lexington Legends are there. go to games and go sit with the scouts. Go buy your ticket that's right by where the scout seats are. Kind of watch what they do. Get up the courage to ask them a question or two at a break. Just tell them you're interested in baseball. It's probably not going to be a career change for you as a 40-something. I mean, it's not something that you really are going to want to get into, because chances are your extinct industry probably pays better too. But if you really are interested in it, go and try and learn. Ask what they're looking for. Ask the things that are important, and ask lots of questions. And because in the end, scouting is about gathering information. It's gathering and sharing information, and that's, you know, whether it's, you know, trying to figure out, you know, whether or not a guy's swing is short enough, or whether or not he has a consistent release point, or just learning about a player or learning about other information from other organizations, they tend to be pretty good at sharing stuff and certainly about paying it forward. I think most of them, at least most of the guys that I've dealt with, are good at helping to teach you what it is that they're looking for.
Sure. So. I mean, and Mark, it comes down to passion. I mean, I told you it wasn't going to happen for you, because I don't think it is. But, I mean, if you have the passion for it and this is what you want to dedicate your life to do, once you get to talk to these scouts, once you realize that it's not a glamorous life, that it's just – that it's a grind and it has to be your existence, if that's what you want to do and you're driven to do it, well, then fucking go get it.
Yeah.
You know, good luck to you, and I wish you the best.
Our next email comes from Andrew in Western North Carolina. He says, "Hello, Jason and Mason."
That's the best one yet.
Yeah. I like that they rhyme. Andrew in Western North Carolina here. I have a question for you fine folks. Jason, when I first started listening to Up and In, I was in a pretty terrible place, but hearing you share your emotional state every week and talk about real things helped me in some fashion get to the point where I'm at today, where everything is beautiful and stuff. Mason, while I cannot stand your ego ever since you founded Grantland, I still like your early Deadspin stuff, as well as the graphic design projects you do for Wired. And who could forget the moving eulogy you gave at Kevin's funeral? R.I.P. Second only to Otto in terms of emotion.
Mason. Classic Mason.
Anyway, my question has to do with the 20/80 or 2/8 scale. While I have to imagine a 20 runner in 1973 and 2013 are pretty much the same, and the same goes for an 8 hit, have the standards for grades over time changed? Imagine it would be in the middle, where what used to be a 55 is now either seen as a clear 50 or 60, or vice versa, because the player crop is just so much different than it was 40 years ago. Well, the two of you are likely not old enough to say from firsthand experience, once again, R.I.P. Kevin. Have you ever heard about this? Thanks, and keep up the slack, Andrew.
I mean, I think players are getting stronger and faster. So, I mean, the slowest runner in the... I mean, Billy Butler is Billy Butler. You know, so a 2 is a 2, but, you know, I think that the one thing about the scouting scale that's a little bit off is that, you know, there aren't as many 5 runners as you would think at the major league level. You know, it seems like the majority of runners are a little bit under that. Like, the average is under what normally would be called a 5 at the minor league level. You know, if I'm watching a guy running a 4.2, you know, from the right side, or 4.25, and I want to put like a 5 on that guy's run, you know, I mean, at the major league level, you're probably not going to see too many guys running that fast. You know, that's just kind of the nature of the beast. As players get older, they tend to slow down. There's some slack and getting down the line. So I think that that's a little bit weird. I mean, I think that the scale can be a little bit skewed, you know, and it's not always, you know, the same at the major league level as it is at the minor league level, unfortunately. But I do think that, you know, grades have changed because athletes have gotten better. They've gotten faster. They've gotten stronger. And so I think that you see a lot more guys now with raw power that would grade out, you know, plus or above than you would back then.
I think, and if I remember this right, there's also a change in the way velocity works on the scale, just based on how radar guns readings work, right? I mean, the old radar guns took velocity more from the front of the plate as opposed to from the release point.
Right.
And so what we would consider, you know, average velocity now would, like 88 to 90, would have been plus velocity before. So that was something that somebody told me once, and I'd never really followed up on it. But it sounds like that at least changed in, I don't know, when did we start going to the juiced guns? 20 years ago?
Yeah.
Maybe, I mean, something like that?
Kids are also getting stronger. I mean, look at what high school kids are doing now. I mean, the top prep arms are already in the mid-90s. That's crazy. You know, that would be an outlier 25 years ago for the most part. I mean, just about every high school arm now you can find out that's coming into the draft early. They got plus fastballs, you know. So I think that, you know, I think we're going to have to alter the scale a little bit going forward. I mean, as more people start to come in and the average fastball is now 92 to 93 miles an hour. I mean, that's not the case yet. But when that becomes the case, then, you know, that used to be plus.
Right, right.
I just think we're getting bigger and stronger, you know.
No, I mean, it's the better athletes today. I mean, everybody is always developing.
Year-round training.
Yeah. Our next email comes from Brian in D.C. It says, "Dear Fringe Average Guys, first off, I just want to say how glad I am to see that Jason kept himself together after Kevin's untimely demise in a tragic fedora-related accident. Matt, I loved your work covering the Champions League for Sky Network in the U.K. and stream your show every chance I get. Keep up the mediocre work, you guys. This year, I've watched several very young and talented hitters with something resembling a track record fall straight off a cliff during the first half of the season. The examples that most immediately come to mind include Giancarlo Stanton, albeit injury-aided, Starlin Castro, and Jason Hayward. My question is this: what reasons do you see for such precipitous and sudden drop-offs in performance? They at least feel like more than just regressions as required by the statistical gods. What are they likely trying to do to remedy this? Not that I expect either of the three that I've listed to do so, but what do you think causes some young players, such as those, with at least some level of success to suddenly flame out? Thanks for taking the time and helping me keep me sane while I study for the bar exam. Best, Brian from D.C.
Are Castro and Hayward flaming out? And I missed
him? No. Well, Hayward is off to a slow start, but you've got to remember he missed something like 3.5 weeks after he had his appendix removed. And I think part of it was kind of getting his timing back. I mean, since this email came in, he had a 2-homer game against San Diego. And I'm not real worried about him. Stanton has been injured. Castro has been a big subject of discussion in Chicago. And, you know, we touched on this a little bit last week indirectly, but, you know, he's a guy that's an aggressive hitter. And R.J. Anderson did a great piece on BP this week talking about the percentage of time that he's swinging at two-strike pitches, and it's a ridiculous amount. But that the Cubs are trying to get him to be more selective, and since they've really started to hammer that home, has coincided pretty well with his struggles, and now hitting in the 250s this season and hitting the 260s over the second half of last year.
Yeah, I remember that discussion, and a lot of it happened before we even started recording, and it was heated, and we were both, like, all oiled up and just...
It was greasy.
Ready to arm wrestle. It was very greasy. There's a lot of things that can go into this. I don't have, like, one answer. I mean, you know, when it comes to Hayward, you could be dealing with a comfort issue and a timing issue because he's coming back from injury. With Castro, you could be talking about an approach issue. And, you know, obviously maybe he's in his head, he's thinking too much. And we talked about this last week a little bit. Ultimately it comes down to, you know, hitting is about, you know, comfort and confidence. And when those start to wane a little bit, you can see production slip. Also, Major League Baseball is very hard. And, you know, when pitchers make that adjustment, then hitters have to make that secondary adjustment. And some are slow to do it. And it takes time. Some never do it. But I think that when you see players, you know, start to regress, I think a lot of it has to do with just, you know, the approach and, you know, the ability to make adjustments. I mean, baseball is a game of adjustments. And, you know, they're constantly adjusting to you, so you have to constantly adjust to them. And that's hard to do when you're also trying to maintain, you know, your confidence and your comfort while doing so. It's difficult. It's really hard to hit.
I'm not sure that there's anything I can really add to that. I mean, I think that's spot on. I mean, it's, you know, with Castro specifically, it's, you know, the league is adjusted to him, and he needs to make another adjustment, whether it's laying off pitches or doing a better job of you know, either understanding what the organization is trying to tell him or scrapping it and going back to being who he was. I mean, I think that's one of the things that gets...
That's the question. Is that what you would do? I mean, I'm asking you, you're now in charge of that philosophy. Would you just let him go back to who he was?
I mean, I don't. Yeah, probably. I want the kid to be comfortable first and foremost. You know, it's not like he's a free swinger where he's swinging at everything. It's just that he has such a great hand-eye coordination that he can make contact with a lot of pitches that other guys can't. But I also think that that's part of what makes him really special as a hitter. I wouldn't mess with him a whole lot. Now, granted, I'm not the major league hitting coach, and maybe there's something that the organization their hitting coach, James Rousen, who seems to have a really good relationship with the young players there, sees that that's different. But, man, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? I mean, that's the thing is that, you know, he's a guy that's got that's really good at hitting off-speed pitches when guys make mistakes. We got an email earlier this year asking about his problem with bat speed, and I've never seen him have a bat speed issue. I think he's got plenty of bat speed. I mean, he can turn on a fastball. I think what you've seen him this year is get caught in between timing-wise, and that kind of manifests itself as bat speed when you see guys consistently late on fastballs or swinging through fastballs that they should hit. It's just because they're not getting their foot down in time, and I think with Castro, I mean, I actually see a lot of similar things with Castro that I saw from Hosmer. You know, I mean, just that
beauty, just beautiful features.
Just dreamy,
natural beauty.
Dreamy eyes. Maybe, you know what, maybe it is that Hosmer needs to shave the beard and Castro needs to grow his. But no, just not getting the foot down in time. Not getting the foot down in time and ended up being late on a fastball. And so, you know, I think that that's, I think with him specifically, that's what it is. But I think we worry too much. You know, all of it is well-meaning. You know, I mean, you're always trying to help the player get better, right?
Oh, no, of course.
But part of the concern is that if you start trying to change stuff that, you know, don't worry about changing it until it doesn't work anymore. You know, that was one of the things that I was one of my favorite flash in the pans. Remember Jeff Stone?
Yeah.
When he came up with the Phillies. Jeff Stone, I'll see if I can pull up Jeff Stone's number. This was around like 1984. And came up with the Phillies and just set the world ablaze. The power, speed, you know, hit. It was just, a monster in a short sample. And the Phillies got concerned about, you know, him. He had 362 in 199 plate appearances in 1984 at the age of 23 and was 27 for 32 in stolen bases.
Jesus, that's a monster.
Yeah, and then, you know, never had more than 282 plate appearances in the season because they tried to make some changes to his swing. They were concerned about, you know, him getting exposed. He never got back, never really got back to being the player that he was, had cups of coffee, you know, beyond that, a couple of half seasons with the Phillies, cup of coffee in Baltimore, cup of coffee nearly 10 years later with Boston. And you just have to understand that until a player needs you to adjust, you can't make adjustments with him. I firmly believe that. And again, this is all well-meaning. You're all looking out, trying to look out for the best interest of the player. But sometimes, I mean, the player's going to tell you when he's ready for the big leagues, right? The player's going to tell you when he's ready for the adjustment, too.
Well said. Good stuff.
Thank you. Our next email says, hey guys, I'm a wee bit nervous to email you both because although I think my baseball knowledge want is serviceable, my baseball knowledge rig is still in its infancy. Needless to say, though, I love your work. I'm writing from New Zealand, where baseball has yet to really take off, but where softball and the somewhat comparable game of cricket are both very much a part of growing up and playing sport. Although I've never played, my good friend introduced me to baseball We grew up playing cricket together about 5 or 6 years ago when he showed me the Twins and Joe Mauer's face, from which point I have followed the game intensely ever since. It's understandable. It's a great face. He's a bit of a nerd. Soon thereafter, he had me reading regularly websites like Baseball Prospectus and Fangraphs, which I now regularly enjoy, chiefly because I find baseball fascinating, but secondly, because I am a journalist by trade and simply love the writing style you find in American Sports Chat. Anyway, to the point, through my work, I've been fortunate enough to talk to a man named Ryan Flynn, who's the chief executive of Baseball New Zealand. This guy is obsessed with the potential talent that exists in New Zealand. Of course he is, I know, but I was fascinated by what he had to say all the same. His premise is that New Zealand youngsters, particularly of Maori and Polynesian descent, are of such physical prowess, Major League Baseball teams simply have to start taking the country seriously as a land of baseball talent. We've had a few kids picked up recently by various franchises, the Red Sox and Pirates most recently, but Flynn said there is still a bevy of untapped talent waiting here. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the sport of rugby, but the high-level rugby players are absolute beasts, most of who are tremendous natural athletes, particularly in terms of physical makeup. Seriously, a 14-year-old Maori or Polynesian kid could easily be mistaken for a full-grown man, and in many cases are often bigger. My question, therefore, is what sort of potential really does exist for a country where there is undoubtedly physical freaks who are quick and strong, but with next to no baseball experience? Flynn said a franchise could operate an academy for about $250,000 a year just to get these kids early and try to teach them fundamentals. As it stands, kids will either play cricket or softball in New Zealand during the summer. How transferable would softball skills be? My question may seem a bit stupid, but how easy is it to turn a physical specimen into a ball player? Is it even worth MLB franchises trying to teach athletes the game when there is no real baseball background in the country, given the huge number of kids who play baseball in America as is? Apologies for the labored email, but I'm interested to hear from your guys' perspective on the likeness of MLB teams really being interested in physical freaks who have little baseball experience and at the most a bit of softball experience. Thanks for your time, Hamish from Wellington, New Zealand. It's a great question.
Yeah, it's fantastic and something we talk about a little bit. I do believe that certain indigenous populations could be a market inefficiency when it comes to talent procurement. That said, I do not believe that you can turn physical specimens into baseball players without a baseball background. I don't think it's possible. I think that if this is something that's going to happen, first of all, I think it's going to cost a lot more than $250,000 a year to operate an academy. Second of all, I think that this would have to be a very, very long-term plan. It would have to be something that, you know, you need to get kids playing baseball at a high level at a very young age. I mean, I love the physical promise that, you know, you're describing. It's very similar to how a lot of teams, especially the Rays, have made Brazil mm-hmm. and the indigenous population of Brazil, you know, and brought those type of physical specimens into academies at a young age. But the problem is that I do not believe from a neurological standpoint that just being a physical beast is enough. I think that you have to have those certain neurological aspects that are developed by playing baseball at an early age in order to play baseball at an older age. I don't think that it's something that the older you get that you're able to pick up. I think that the older you get, the harder it becomes to refine these certain neurological functions. So no, I do not believe that just picking, you know, the strongest and fastest people that you can find and then asking them to play baseball players is going to develop much, you know, along the lines of major league talent. But I do think that if you had a long-term plan in place to teach people baseball at a very young age by, you know, maybe even sponsored leagues, something where you can get a kid playing baseball, you know, from an indigenous population at a very young age so they can acquire the necessary neurological skills to play baseball, then you have something there. But that's a long-term project.
Do you think age 10, 12, somewhere around there?
Yeah, 10 to 12. That's when I would make sure that there's a lot of baseball being played.
I think it's absolutely worth Major League Baseball, you know, trying to invest. I mean, they're always looking for opportunities. I think one of the things that you'll see with the CBA, because teams are trying to find a better way to spend what little money they have internationally, they're going to start looking in places like Brazil and maybe even New Zealand, where I don't know if they'll invest in an academy necessarily, but they will be trying to figure out if there is some talent there to try and harvest, because it's going to be very important to get more bang for your buck. It would implore them to feel like scout areas like New Zealand, scout, you know, Europe even, you know, scout wherever. Look, if you're going to try and invest globally, you know, if you can find a guy that you can sign for $10,000 who may have a ton of raw skills, is it a better investment to try and go out and get that guy than to take him, a similar player from the Dominican Republic that may have a price tag of 10 to 15 times as much?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I would love to find, you know, a member of an indigenous population that's just, you know, physically gifted that has been playing cricket, you know, since they were 4 years old or something and had like some incredible hand-eye coordination and was able to pick up the ball, although it's a little bit different. I'd like to work with something like that. You know, I think that would be really interesting. Like the Pirates going to India to get those young kids mm-hmm. a few years ago. It didn't work, but I thought it was really interesting and I liked what they were doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, why not take a chance at it? I mean, especially if it's not going to cost you a ton of money. I mean, teams are looking to save money any way they can. I mean, if it costs you $1 million to start an academy in New Zealand, is it worth it?
Absolutely. If it costs you $10 million over 10 years, and you're able to develop two or three major league players from that, hell yeah, it's worth it. It's definitely worth it.
Our next email, dear Mike and Jason, I'm enjoying the podcast and glad to have something to help pass my hour-plus commute in the late-night drives. I had the opportunity to meet Jason in Lakewood, New Jersey last year and hope he'll be returning for the Hickory series in July, despite the fact he couldn't find a bar open after 10 p.m. over there.
That's disappointing.
Post Sandy, the Jersey Shore needs all the help it can get. I also wonder if Mike has a hard time going from the podcast where he can use profanity at will to his day job where presumably it is verboten. No, it's not that hard. On to my question. All of the discussion leads up to the MLB draft and got me to thinking about the next step of the process, signing or for the high school players electing to go to college. Much is made of the leverage high school seniors have in contract negotiations because of their commitments to major college programs. My question is this. Do the college coaches try and hold on to the newly drafted recruits? Conversely, do they ever or often tell the signees that they would be crazy to pass up a 6- or 7-figure bonus? Or do they not have any contact with the players between the draft and the end of the signing period? What about the college junior draftees, players with whom the coaches have developed a relationship over 3 years as opposed to a handful of recruiting visits? Do they encourage them to stay or to go or to try to influence their decision in any way? To take it further, if you wish, how do college coaches handle the recruiting process for elite players whom they know are likely to be high draft picks and may never set foot on campus? Is there a scramble over the summer to recruit additional players as some of the commits opt for instructional and complex leagues and minor league bus trips instead of college classrooms and college ball? Questions from Jonathan in Mount Laurel, New Jersey.
It's a good question. I mean, it's a complicated question, and I think it needs to be tailored specific to the player and to the college program. I mean, not every player is the same. Not every college program has the same objective. You know, I think that it's important for colleges to, you know, to be honest with these players about their future as much as they could help their own program, you know, because ultimately it's about the kid. It's about what's best for the kid, not what's best for the program or the pro team. I mean, you know, I've run into a lot of college coaches over the years, and the majority that I've run into, as much as they want to win, they care about the kids a lot. And so, you know, I've definitely heard stories of college coaches saying, look, you may not ever have an opportunity like this again. I think that, you know, given your familial situation, perhaps that, you know, it'd be best if you went ahead and took the money. Whereas others aren't, it's not as black and white as that. You know, for the most part, you know, I'm all for kids like in high school going to the pros. I think that you can't replicate that sort of instruction. You can't replicate that sort of environment. And I'd like to get you into the developmental system as fast as possible. That's just for me. You know, obviously, you know, a college coach will stay on a high-ranked kid because what if something goes wrong in the contract negotiation and they decide to go to school? Well, then you get a superstar at your school and your life just got a whole lot better.
Well, I think there's a couple different things to keep in mind here. One, I know that a lot of at least the good college coaches, when they know that they've got a guy who's got a chance to go high in the draft, they're not going to try and tell him to turn down $1 million to go to college. You know, I've mentioned it before, I get to work with Cliff Floyd now and again, and Cliff tells a story. He was committed to go to Creighton when he was drafted, and I think he was the 17th overall pick or something like that. And Jim Hendry, who ended up being general manager of the Cubs, was the coach at Creighton at the time. And, you know, Cliff had committed there, and they were getting close to the draft. And Jim told him flat out, he said, listen, you're going to go in the first round. You're going to take the money. And he was like, no, coach, I'm going to come to college. He goes, are you crazy? Go play pro baseball. Go.
Yeah, but he probably remembers that guy for the rest of his life for what he, you know, the way he stood behind him there, the way he pushed him towards a decision.
Absolutely. Absolutely he does, and he still appreciates it. Not every guy who gets picked and not every guy who gets picked high is ready for college or is ready for pro ball. We'll right. talk about Garrett Cole in a little bit, who's a really interesting situation in that. And so it's about, you know, part of it's about maturity. And I think that if a coach really senses that a player could use those three years, then he might push him a little bit more, might say, you know, you really need to consider this. Whereas if he thinks the guy is ready and ready to go and, you know, he's a first round draft pick, say, oh, well. Now, as for reallocating those scholarships, so baseball only gets 11.7 scholarships. And as a result, they have to end up dividing it up. Very rarely do you get a guy who is in college on a full ride to play baseball. Generally, what happens is that they're on half scholarships or, you know, they might be 60%, 40%, 25%, something like that. So what you may do is you may have a host of walk-ons that you kind of have in the wings that you're then able able to offer scholarship money to if that one guy turns it down. So let's say he's on a 60% ride or you know, close to it. I mean, if it's a really elite guy, it might be closer to a full ride, say 75%. You know, maybe you can spread that out to three guys who are kind of committed walk-ons for the next year that you can say, hey, listen, you know, we're going to pay for some of your college because we think you're an important part of the program. It's very complicated with college baseball because the number of scholarships are so low.
Yeah, and it's also one of the things that you know, when you're dealing with multi-sport athletes, that would deter some of those guys to going to play baseball in college because of that scholarship issue.
You know, Major League Baseball, we were actually talking about this again the other day, but Major League Baseball last year was at least looking into funding extra additional scholarships for the Division I baseball programs so that they could get closer to, I think it used to be 14 or 15 before this latest round of cuts, and that they would try and you know, fund so that teams could be basically fully funded again, that they could end up with 15 scholarships again. Now, there's some other stuff with it. I mean, they would end up having to do the same for softball because of Title IX, which I actually think would be a fantastic PR move for Major League Baseball at the very least, and really just a nice move when it comes to, you know, social equality. I think it would be great if they were to do that. But I wonder what kind of pitfalls there are in that, you know, in Major League, if Major League Baseball starts paying for a chunk of scholarships, if they're going to try and tell coaches, okay, well, we're going to do this, but, you know, when your starter throws 120 pitches in the final game of regionals and you want to bring him back on short rest in the first game of Supers, or if it's, you know, like with Kent Emanuel from North Carolina, who pitched the first game, threw 120 games, and then threw 51 in the final game of the regionals to push them on, if Major League Baseball may want to try and get and coaches' heads on them because they say, "Hey, man, we're footing the bill." I think that there's some, you know, there's always some unintended consequences or some other things that can come about with something like that.
I think that that's dangerous because, I mean, we've said this before. College coaches are trying to win at the college level. They're not, you know, as much as they care about the kids, it's not a pro system. They're not worried about, you know, they're trying to win. Their job is to win. You know, a player's job at the pro level is to develop. You know, that's why, you know, you don't see that same sort of activity in the lower minors when, you know, even teams are in the playoffs. You know, you don't see that sort of, you know, everything for the win. I mean, these players are being developed so that they can contribute to the major league squad someday. And, you know, college, I think it'd be a very dangerous situation to have Major League Baseball have influence over the college ranks.
Our next question comes from Patrick in Chicago. In the flurry of discussion regarding the draft last week, one of my favorite stories I caught was regarding Hal Newhouser and Derek Jeter. Newhouser advised the Astros to take Jeter with every bit of passion he had left in the game. When the Astros took Phil Nevin instead, Newhouser ultimately ended up retiring. This got me thinking of a nice two-prong question for Jason. Do you have any stories of highly touting a prospect, and I mean Lindor-style touting, where the prospect just did not pan out? I'm just curious if you ever had seen a guy and thought he was as close to a can't miss as a guy can be, and then he missed by a significant amount. Also, do you have a story about going against the grain? Perhaps the collective opinion was that the guy didn't have the tools and the makeup, and you saw something in them where they eventually grew into a successful player. Patrick in Chicago.
This is a great question. This is probably my favorite one so far. Just because I love this process. The process of failure, mm-hmm. in the scouting world, it's fantastic. I mean, I am extremely fortunate, as are you, that we get to listen to some really, really, you know, fantastic and intelligent industry minds, you know, from general managers to longtime scouts to heads of player development. And, you know, I just shut up and I just listen to some of their stories. And, you know, I've heard countless stories about the process of scouting Jeter in high school and sitting down with him in the living room. And one story in particular I'll tell, and I won't give the name of the person who told it to me, but the former GM of a team just told me, like, yeah, we were all over Jeter. We were sort of sitting, you know, in his living room talking to him. And I asked him, you know, do you want to win an MVP someday? And he said, it's not, you know, I'm not interested in that. He goes, I want a handful of rings. And, you know, you know, and of course the organization, they went outside and they had a circle jerk, you know, right there in his yard. You know? And the only problem was is that they knew that that kid wasn't going to fall to them, but they also knew what that kid was. They could tell right from the beginning, and this is it's one of the intangible parts of baseball. The makeup thing is huge, especially when you're looking at some of these young players. Now, as far as instead of saying what I hit on, I'll say a couple of guys that I missed on. One was a star. Back on the instructional league, I was watching a guy named Josh Vitters.
Yeah.
When he was first around, and I was relatively new to it, and he was the first guy that I saw on a backfield that I went, whoa, that's not normal. That's different, you know, because his swing, I mean, it was angelic, you know, I mean, it was crazy. I mean, I couldn't believe how much, you know, his swing looked compared to everybody else on the field. I thought that I was looking at a future, you know, Hall of Famer based on, you know, my inexperience at the time. I loved watching his swing. I thought that he was going to be a Roll 7 All-Star player no matter what. I mean, I thought it was the prettiest right-handed swing I had really ever seen. And given the context of where I was watching it, he stood out. And I did. I mean, I was smitten from day one. You know, he didn't make it, and he's not going to make it to the level that we all thought he was. And that was like, oh man, I thought he was going to be a star. And I think about that all the time. I think about that when my eyes first saw him swing on the backfield. I remember what that felt like because it made me feel something, which is important. Along those lines, you know, the Rangers have a guy named Craig Gentry. He's like a fourth outfielder type. You know, I watched him for years in the minors, and I thought he was a non-prospect. I mean, anytime anybody would ask me, is Gentry a prospect, I'd be like, maybe. I mean, but I didn't even give him a fringe average. I mean, I gave him like an NP most of the time. I just thought he could run a little bit. You know, and he's turned into one of the better, you know, fourth outfielders as far as like defensive specialist goes. I mean, the guy is a really, really good center fielder. He's got a really good arm. He's really, really fast. He can hit left-handed pitching. He's not very good. He's not a very good stick, but he's a, you know, a legit major leaguer, at least a fourth or fifth outfielder, you know, on a very good team. And I never thought he was going to get there. So I was absolutely wrong when it comes to a guy like Gentry. And I was absolutely wrong when it comes to a guy like Vitters. What about you?
I mean, I don't think that I have enough experience to really guess either way on this. I'm trying to think if there was anybody. I mean, the closest I come is a couple of years ago when I was doing games for Bowie. They had a reliever there named Pat Egan, who was, he was just kind of he had like a middle relief profile, but I was sure he was going to be a major leaguer. I mean, it was 94 with heavy sink, and he wasn't missing a ton of bats. But, I mean, he was getting ground ball after ground ball after ground ball, and for multiple innings at a time, was just really ramped up in the middle innings, and I was sure he was going to get there. They put him up to AAA, and he struggled a little bit. Kansas City took him in the Rule 5, and he got knocked around in spring training, came back, and has just never – hasn't really been heard from again. But that was a guy that I thought was going to get there, but I didn't think he was going to be a star necessarily. I'm not sure that there's anybody that I've seen that I went, man, I think that guy's going to be a monster – that hasn't gotten there. I've heard plenty of stories. I mean, there were the stories that I heard a lot around here were about Wieters when he was in the minor leagues. I had one scout tell me, he's like, if that guy doesn't become a superstar, I might as well just quit. And this was when he was going through his struggles in his second season. And I don't think that he's – I think there were probably unfair expectations that were put on Wieters as to what he could be offensively because he's not that guy. He's still a hell of a player. I mean, he is an all-star catcher. But he's a completely different player than what everybody expected. They expect him to be the offensive monster who might be able to catch. And he's a great catcher who just – you know, he's got enough power that has an impact for the position as opposed to being an MVP candidate.
What I hope is that we're not having this discussion a couple years down the line. One, that would mean we're still doing this podcast a couple years down the line, which means that, you know, we're not really progressing. And two, if the person I'm talking about is, you know, we've both been really high on Eric Hosmer. I mean, at the minor league level, I was telling everybody that I thought he was going to be a perennial all-star, maybe even an MVP candidate, despite being a first baseman. I thought his bat was going to be that special, you know, a 6'7" type of hit tool power type of guy, maybe even a 7'6" or a 7'7". You know, obviously he's still got a lot of time to turn this around. He's got a lot of time to live up to the expectations, but in a couple of years we could be talking about a guy that we missed on.
Yeah, we could. But I mean, he's been swinging the bat better. He's at least had a better approach over the last couple of weeks, I feel like. But hopefully we're right and then we're – I don't even know what I'm saying. On to the next email. The next email says, greetings, Mike and Jason and Mark, Matt, Mitch, et al. First of all, thanks for bringing Fringe Average to the podcast world. I have a backlog of around 70 or so podcasts that I play when I have time, something that is in short supply around here. But Fringe Average is one of the few for which I have no backlog and to which I listen as soon as it comes out. You do a great job. If you ever bring a Baseball Prospectus Roadshow to a minor league venue, we'd love to have you come to the Raleigh-Durham area. Actually, I think that sounds like it would be a lot of fun. I can think of a lot worse places to be than Raleigh-Durham. I love it there.
Sure, I'd love to go.
I think that would be good. Let's see if we can get that going. In response to questions about Gerrit Cole's recall earlier this week, Pirates GM Neil Huntington said this. There's certainly discomfort because in an ideal world, it is probably a little early. There are still some things he needs to work on. The worst reason you can bring a prospect to the major leagues is because of a need, and we've been able to avoid that until now. My question is, what tells a major league team that a prospect is ready to come to the majors? It seems to me, as a longtime Pirate fan, as though they use the not ready for the majors, still has things to work on comment a lot more than most of us would like, with the suspicion being that the team's primary concern is avoiding an early start on the service time clock rather than being sure that the prospect has fully worked out all the kinks and is truly ready to make a contribution at the major league level. Jason has said on several occasions that there are some things a prospect has to work out in the major leagues that simply can't be done at AAA, and that makes a lot of sense to me, yet we continue to hear GMs like Huntington and usually from low revenue teams make comments like this on a regular basis. So what might the things be that indicate that Gerrit Cole is perhaps not yet ready for the major leagues, and can those things, whatever they might be, really hinder his development in the long term if he were working on the majors rather than working on them at Indianapolis? Your comments would be appreciated. Thanks very much. And I've omitted his name, so now I've got to look it up here on my list. It's a great question, especially seeing as we just saw Gerrit Cole pitch last night.
We did, and I thought he was really good. I thought that, I thought his fastball looked really crisp. I liked the way he went about using it. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But as far as this question, my thoughts on it, I may be wrong, but I think that you promote players when they're in need of a challenge. You know, I think that jump from AAA to the majors is the biggest jump in the sport. I think it's a lot bigger than people realize, and I think that despite the fact that Gerrit Cole can sit 96 and touch 99 with his fastball, and the fact that he was a mature college pitcher, the fact that he's 22 years old, the fact that he's got all these, he was 1-1, the fact that he's got all these pitches that grade out high, there's still some things to work on, and I'm glad. I think that, I was glad. I thought he was good at the major league level, but obviously their secondary stuff is not as crisp as it will be down the line. We also don't know about any kind of the things that are going on in the maturation process that aren't on the field. You know, we look at the fastball, we look at the secondary stuff. That's what we see. But, players grow up in other ways as well. You have to learn how to be a major leaguer. And sometimes that can start at the minor league level, and you start to, mature in your approach to the game. I can't speak to that, but I think that people are promoted for the most part based on the necessity of challenge. When you need to be presented with something that will force you to make adjustments and to improve and to refine as a result.
But I also think it's based on necessity, and I'll throw the Mike Zunino call up in here with this, because I think everybody in the Mariners organization would tell you, you're right, he hasn't earned the call up based on his performance at AAA, but most of the time it's because of necessity. Go and look at what's happened to the Mariners catching situation since we were there, right? We were there the day, basically the day after they sent Montero down, right? So Montero gets sent down because they don't want him to catch all that much anymore. They want him to really focus on being a DH. They bring up Jesus Sucre. Montero tears up his knee. He has to have surgery. Sucre goes on the disabled list because he catches a bat on the back of the hand. So in the interim, they have to bring up a guy from AA who's the backup catcher there, just to have some fill-in on the big league level while they decide whether or not it's the right time to add Zunino to the 40-man roster and bring him to the big leagues. They get the report on Sucre. They figure out it's only going to be a couple weeks. So, all right. So they bring Zunino up. They put him in the big leagues. And it's not going to stunt his development for him being there 2 weeks. I went on a long rant on this today on the radio. It's not going to stunt his development for being in the big leagues for 2 weeks. It's going to give him an opportunity against some higher-level competition. It's not going to ruin the franchise for the next 7 years because he's there. He's there because he needed him. because they needed a catcher,
right,
because he's closer to being a major league capable catcher than the guy that they had up who they were forced into using because of the injuries. And so part of it's necessity, and that's what happened with Cole. It was necessity. I'd say the other thing that is the difference in this is that, you know, that you can talk about what he needs to develop at the big league level, but, man, the big league level is supposed to be for winning. You know, and especially if you're in the spot where Pittsburgh is, and that may sound like it's, you know, cliche or what, but you can't be worrying about a guy's development if you're Pittsburgh and you're in a pennant race. That's not your concern. Well, you need to give your team the best opportunity to win a game on a daily basis, whether it's one game or 20 games or whatever it is. And worrying a little bit about his development, it doesn't matter as much. You know, he's going to have to make adjustments. Sure, he's going to have to learn how to pitch at the big league level. He's going to have to do all of that. But development is what happens in the minor leagues. I saw a great – I got to find it again. Tony Cingrani was asked about this. And our buddy Trent Rosecrans
–
Trent, Trent Rosecrans, who, if you don't read in the Cincinnati Inquirer, you're missing out. He runs the Blog Above Replacement, I believe is what it's called, or Wins Above Replacement blog, or whatever. I think it's Blog Above Replacement Bar, which is appropriate because he likes to drink beer. But since Tony Cingrani sums it up nicely, up here you have to win. In the minors, you work on things. That's exactly fucking it. That's it. You know, and you have to win at the big league level. That's it.
I love that quote. I saw Trent put that out earlier, and I just thought it was money.
Yeah, so we'll talk.
He's money too. I love Trent.
Yeah, man, he's just an awesome guy. Awesome
great
guy.
Great beer drinker.
Yes, he is America.
he is America. He's American too.
All right, our last email. First off, I listen to the podcast via iTunes, so I never read the episode descriptions found on the website. But while looking up the email address, I found them, and holy hell, they're funny. Good work. Thank you very much. My question has to do with sequencing. I suppose, especially with regards to fastballs, I often hear any given hitter can kill a fastball, and that major leaguers could time a jet if they had to. If it's such common knowledge that a major league caliber hitter can do damage with a fastball, why is a fastball used as much as it is? I understand that it works in tandem with off-speed stuff to change eye levels and timing, but it does seem like more of a pillar in a pitcher's repertoire than maybe it should be. How does it get to a point in an at-bat where a major league hitter could ever be sitting on a fastball, even in a 3-2 count? And with regards to rookies, how is it not standard practice to stay off-speed with them? Jason himself has spoken plainly about how good the average major league caliber breaking ball is. Relative to most anything in the minors, why ever throw a rookie a fastball? Hopefully I don't sound like a bonehead. Thanks, Mike. I know, I actually think it's a great question, and it talks a lot about, you know, sequencing and how pitchers have to attack.
I mean, simply put, the fastball forces a reaction. You know, it's the fastest reaction. That's why it's a pillar of a repertoire. I mean, it forces the hitter to make that split second decision. You know, to hit a fastball, you have to trigger, and you have to trigger very quickly. You have to make that decision. You have to commit. That's what makes the secondary pitches so effective. If you made a decision not to throw a rookie a fastball, well, I mean, they just sit back and hit the soft stuff, and it wouldn't look nearly as good if it's not played off the fastball, my opinion.
Yeah, no, and I think that there's – I mean, I think part of it comes with sequencing. First of all, I think the fastball should be the easiest thing for you to control. So if you're able to put it in a location that's difficult to hit, then you have the advantage with it. I remember Bob Howry asking him about his sequencing once, and he talked about the fact that he felt like he could throw 90% fastballs, and really he did for most of his career. It was like 85%, that he could be effective if he could throw his fastball 90% of the time, so long as he could command it and locate it. And I think that's really what it comes down to, is that's the pitch that you can throw for a strike. And a 95-mile-an-hour fastball that's down the middle, hitters react to differently than a 95-mile-an-hour fastball that's up and in or that's low and away. Low and away, they've got a little more time to react. Up and in, they don't have as much. And so it becomes more about location than anything with that. The other part with when it comes to throwing off speed to young guys is that there's a risk-reward to it, too. If you make a mistake, you're speeding up their bat. And if you're speeding up their bat, there's a better chance that they're going to end up getting a hit on it. Now, the other part of this is that it's something that a pitcher told me. So that, you know, there's nothing more that shakes a hitter's confidence more than getting him to swing through a fastball. You know, hitters. We've talked a lot about how confidence is so important for hitters, right? And so maybe there's part of it that's machismo too. But if you can get a hitter, if you've got their timing off, and you can get them to swing through a fastball, especially a young player, I can really fuck with them. And maybe it sets you up to be able to attack them better in at bats throughout the rest of the day.
That's an excellent point.
So, do you ever do anything with effective velocity? You ever check out this guy Perry Husband's work? Doug Thorburn hipped me to him.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it, but I haven't got in deep. No,
it's interesting just about how perceived velocity works with you know actual velocity versus perceived velocity. Check it out. It's hittingisaguess.com is the guy, Perry Husband's his name, but it's worth taking a look at just for sequencing and stuff like that. So, all right, this week's Fringe Average Podcast, that's it for the emails. This week's Fringe Average Podcast is brought to you by Intrepid Inspections. You go to intrepidinspections.com as they bring the same high-level thought and process to insurance inspections that Baseball Prospectus brings to baseball. We are breakless this week just because we got to keep rolling through. But we touched on a little in the email segment. Gerrit Cole made his Major League debut last night. What were your impressions of Gerrit Cole, who was, I would say, fastball heavy?
Yeah, he was fastball heavy, but he's a fastball heavy pitcher. I think that, you know, I've said this before. Not that I've had to defend him, but, I mean, last year Baseball Prospectus ranked him, coming into this year, we ranked him the top pitcher in baseball, and you know, obviously one of the top prospects in baseball. And I've always kind of said this, that like I think he's going to end up being a better major league pitcher than he was a minor league prospect. I think that there are just certain things that he hasn't been able to put together yet in the whole pitching puzzle. And I think that once it comes together, whether that happens in his year 23 or his year 26, that I think that he is going to be that true top of the rotation type of guy. I think that he's got the competitiveness for it. You know, he's got that fire. Remember him at the Futures game, like wanting to know who was going to throw harder than him and like going out and hitting 101. I mean, that's rig. You know, Fernandez had the same thing and we were all like, you know, oh, wow, Fernandez is this competitive kid. Well, Cole's the same way. You know, I mean, he had a little bit of a reputation as a titty baby at UCLA. But, I mean, he's grown up a lot, you know, and I think that some of his struggles in the minors, be it, you know, they haven't been that tremendous or that exaggerated, but I think that they've humbled him a little bit and they've matured him a little bit. I think that, you know, the way he pitched in the game was, you know, a good base of how he's going to pitch maybe the rest of this season. I mean, it's fastball heavy. It's his comfort pitch. It's the pitch he feels, you know, the best about. And, you know, he was able to locate it. He was able to get ahead early. Obviously, it was a potent offering. You know, I mean, he was really bringing it. I mean, he's got that type of body that, you know, even if he doesn't develop into that 1-1 guy, he's gonna log innings. Mm-hmm. Man, that guy is going to chew. And there is a lot of value in guys who can just chew, even if he doesn't reach his ultimate ceiling. Obviously, I think that the secondary stuff did look like a lot what it did in the minors. It flashed. I think that they're going to gain steam. And they're going to start working it into the arsenal more. But in your first start, you know, it's his first major league start, man. Of course, he's going to ride the fastball heavy. I mean, it's the pitch that he feels the most comfortable with, and it's also a major league quality pitch at a high level. So, I mean, I wasn't surprised to see him step on that fastball a lot. Were you?
No, and in fact, I thought it was pretty great that he was able to. I got into a Twitter discussion last night with Howard Megdahl from Sports on Earth, who then wrote a piece today on it that was a little bit, would you say it was doom and gloomy on Cole? That you know, here was the great results in the start, but he used his fastball so much. And I was impressed that not only did he use his fastball that much, but that he could locate it and that he got so much weak contact on it. I mean, I don't really feel like until, you know, Tony Abreu's double that chased him, that he really gave up a hard hit ball in that outing. And that's part of it is, you know, listen, strikeouts are great. They're important. You need to be able to miss bats, right? And he only struck out two, and I think that's going to be some of the focus on it. But he got a lot of ground ball outs on his fastball with a good infield defense behind him, and it's not like guys were rocketing the ball through the infield. Now, if you leave a guy to put a ball in play, does it leave you open for, you know, more things that can go wrong? Sure, but if you're able to get ground balls consistently, you're going to get out of a lot of innings, and I think he's going to miss more bats. I think, I mean, he the fastball had more life than I expected. I'll tell you that. There were some ugly swings on that fastball last night that I thought it was going to be straighter just from the way people had talked about it. There was a little hop to it.
Oh, yeah.
And if you've got that kind of late life down in the zone, fuck. You're a monster in the making. It was his first big league start. He went up against an A line. I know that they've, you know, no Sandoval, but the Giants have been a pretty good offensive team this year. He went up against a major league lineup and shut him down. You know, set down 13 guys in a row at one point and didn't look like he was breaking a sweat. I thought it was a really impressive performance. It way exceeded what my expectations were. I thought he'd walk a few guys and you know, maybe have some strikeouts and maybe struggle to get out of the fifth because his pitch count got too high. That's not what I saw last night. I saw a pitcher, a guy who knew how to pitch. And that's scary because he's got stuff of a guy who doesn't know how to pitch. You know what I mean? Like, he's got stuff of a thrower.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just don't understand the bitch. You know, I don't understand why some people have to write about baseball the way that they want it to be as opposed to the way it actually is. You know, I mean, Gerrit Cole's job is to get outs, all right? His job, a pitcher's job is to get outs. You know, strikeouts are definitely an efficient means to do so. But so weak contact is as well, especially when you have a quality defense behind you. And I thought Gerrit Cole, for his first start, riding the fastball, I mean, what do you expect for him to do? Do you expect him to come out and throw, you know, an 80-grade fastball and 270-grade secondary pitches and just and sequence and pitch backwards and do all these things veteran pitchers do? The kid's 22 years old making his first start. I mean, there has to be some perspective here.
No, and I don't think it was all that much different than Michael Wacha's first start in that regard. You know, I mean, Wacha used his fastball almost exclusively in that. Heck, Walker's used his fastball almost exclusively in all three of his starts because he's still trying to get a feel for how he can use his breaking pitches. How he, you know, he's I think it's incumbent on the catcher to call a game like that too with a young player. Listen, if you know he's got a good fastball, then use it. Use it. You know, I understand getting caught up in, and I'm as guilty as anyone. Swing and miss, strikeouts. I get it. I'm with you. I completely agree. They're very, very important.
Of course.
But so is weak contact. And just saying, this guy only struck out two, or, he threw 14 sliders, but only seven of them were strikes. Man, I don't want him throwing a slider for strikes all that often. You know, unless he's pitching a guy backwards. I want him to pitch out of the zone, but I want to make sure it's one that can be chased. And he threw one last night to Buster Posey that Posey chased. That was a bitch. I mean, there it is. There I saw it, right? I mean, that was the moment. So, I thought it was way better than I think even the Pirates could have expected. Way, way better.
Of course. And, you know, I mean, it's just one of those things. It's like, you know, it's like getting the 13 hits off of Wainwright but not walking. And so there's something to bitch about.
Yeah. I mean, it's.
I understand it.
By the way, the Pirates.
You have to make the game something that, you know, that you want it to be. Just, you know, analyze what's there.
Right. Right. By the way, the Pirates have confirmed that Gerrit Cole is going to start on Sunday against the Dodgers. I would say he earned another one. I'd say he earned another chance to start.
You think he's going down?
That's a good question. I mean, I think based on the way he pitched in his first start, it would be easy to say, no way is he going back. But, you know, let's see what happens with him the rest of the season. I mean, they're in a position where they needed him because Wandy Rodriguez had some elbow soreness. Fortunately, there's no structural damage. You know, they lost Genmar Gomez, who is going to be done for the year. They got Charlie Morton coming back from injury. And I know none of these guys have the upside that Cole has, but now, they may have a better idea of how to get major league hitters out the second time you go through the league. I think even with the start that he had, and yeah, I mean, you hit on it. I mean, he didn't work in his breaking pitches a whole lot. He didn't work in the changeup a whole lot. Let's see how he makes adjustments. I don't want to say that he's not going back down, but he certainly pitched like a guy who belongs in his first start.
I thought so. I thought it was fine. I mean, there's always going to be things that we can nitpick, or we can look at his performance and tear it apart. And I think that that's still a good thing. I mean, I think that there's got to be a form of that. But when you look at the context of what he did and when he did it and how he did it, the lack of strikeouts. I mean, to me, that's not a big complaint right now. I mean, maybe if it becomes a pattern like it has been in the minor leagues at the major league level. But I mean, he faced a really, really competent major league lineup and got outs, which is his job. That's a pitcher's job, and that's it. You can do it in a sexy manner, or you can do it in a way that's not so attractive, but, you know, getting outs is all that matters.
Well, and if you're going to throw 75 or 80% of your fastballs, at least make sure that they're low in the zone. And that's what – I mean, Tony Cingrani's only throwing a fastball, right? What's he done through his – you know, he came back up and shoved again. I know it's the Cubs, but he shoved against them again last night. You know?
I like Cingrani. I think he's a good pitcher.
Do you think he's a starter long-term or not?
I don't know. I think he needs to get a better breaking ball, obviously. This has been the knock on him throughout the minors. I mean, I think his changeup is good because it can play off that fastball because he throws his fastball so often. The fastball's got that deception to it, both mechanically and like the way it comes out of the hand. I think that I'd like to see him start. I mean, I don't know why he can't, you know, put a cutter together or put a slider that's just even a show me pitch. I think he can stick around for a little while in the rotation. I like him. I think he's a smart guy too.
I mean, he certainly doesn't. Well, of course he's a smart guy. I mean, he's from Chicago, but he hasn't done anything to warrant a move to the bullpen at this point. 40 big league innings and. Let's see, what is it? 40 innings, 46 strikeouts. He's given up, 29 hits in that time? No. And walking, what, two guys per nine, two and a half guys per nine? I mean, pretty good run that he's been on so far as a basically a two-pitch guy. So, all right, so we're done with the draft, which means that it's about mid-season, which means that it's about time for you to put together your mid-season top 50 prospect list. How's that coming?
It's coming along nicely. I mean, I don't like doing it, but what I do like to do is, you know, getting on the phone with scouts and, like, saying, oh, you know, one of my favorite games to play is this guy or this guy, this guy or this guy, this guy or this guy, just to get, you know, a lot of different opinion. And, you know, lately I've been doing the Buxton Tavares thing. And oddly enough, I mean, I know that you can get accused of, you know, it's the shiny new toy. You know, he's the hot new handheld that's going around. He's the new smartphone. But, you know, I've yet to be convinced by scouts who have seen both players this year that Tavares is actually the better prospect. Now, the same scout that told me that he put an 8 on Tavares' hit tool and expects him to win a batting title someday said that Buxton is the superior prospect because even when he goes 0-for-4, he impacts the game. He can impact the game on base. He can impact the game in the field, and he can impact the game at the plate. He is a true impact talent and the number one prospect in baseball. And just as a little, a blast, we do plan on ranking Buxton the number one prospect in baseball.
Whoa, that's interesting.
Well, we were also higher on him coming into the season than other publications. I mean, we had him number one in the Twins system. We had him in the top 10. Of all talent coming into the 2013 season. As much as I love Tavares, and, you know, you can definitely make a case for Tavares at one, I think that you can make a more compelling case for Buxton at one. And I think that that's, you know, I'm doing my homework on this. And I'm asking not only scouts, I'm asking front office people, like, who would you rather have? You get to choose between those two people. Who would you rather have? Buxton is winning out, even though Tavares is in AAA and ready to impact at the major league level. Buxton is winning that debate. And to me, that says a lot.
Now, the question is, how much longer is he going to be in the Midwest League?
You know what? I get asked that every day on Twitter about 450 times.
Well, I'm going to ask you here because there's nothing left for him to learn there, though.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that he's ready for a challenge. I'm not even sure that the Florida State League is that challenge. I mean, I think he's a guy that you could put him in AA right now, and I think that that would be a better test and a better challenge for him. But again, it's not my developmental system.
Right.
You know, as a fan, I want him to get promoted to New Britain so that I can go see him next week when I go see Sano.
Oh, you're going to see Sano next week. See, so New Britain.
The week after. The 28th, actually, so it's the week after. I'm going to go sit on that Reading series with New Britain.
New Britain was just here, and not only could I not make it, I got lucky. Meyer got scratched. By the way, I got a text from a scout last week who told me he's convinced that Meyer's a starter.
I get those, and then I get the other ones that say I'm convinced he's a reliever.
This guy had an interesting. I want you to keep this in the back of your head because I don't think we have time to discuss it now. But I want to pull this up and read it to you because I thought it was interesting. It was he said about relievers. He said they're they're putting reliever stamps on pitchers way too early. And I asked him why he thought that was. He says, I'm not sure, but it's too easy to say that he won't be a starter these days. Maybe because these guys don't throw enough in low A, high A, double A, or throw enough breaking pitches in that, and so that they don't see it enough from them. But I thought it was a really interesting kind of take that people he felt, and this guy's been a scout for a long time, felt like people are putting around the reliever tag on guys too soon these days, that it's happened a lot. Just think about that.
We had talked about it on the show a few episodes back when we talked about how the reliever tag is a bit premature and that it's really easy
to
do it. And yeah, we did. I said it. So
I must not have been.
I
must not have been paying attention to something you said. How rude of me!
Yeah, well,
maybe that's why it resonated with me, because you'd already said it.
Yeah, I say it's really easy to put a guy in a reliever box because you know your viewing sample is usually pretty small, and right. You might get a start where you know maybe the breaking ball wasn't used a lot, or maybe the changeup wasn't forced enough, or. You know, it just comes down to the context of your sample. And, you know, I think it's easy to put a guy like Meyer in the bullpen because of the length that he has, because, you know, it's like a guy like Helwig, which might have been the guy we were talking about in the first place when this discussion came about.
We were. Now I remember. Yes.
Because, you know, you look at those levers, you look at, you know, the inconsistency and how he can dominate for 3 or 4 innings at a stretch, and then he completely loses it and doesn't have the same type of feel or compact delivery that he can get back into it quickly. He's not a quick adjustment type of guy because of the size of his body. And so a lot of those guys get put into the reliever box. A lot of the short pitchers get put into the reliever box as well for a different reason, you know, for a durability reason or for whatever. You know, so it's much easier to put a guy in a reliever box than it is to just scout and be honest about his weaknesses and see if those are things that he can refine over time. I think that we're very premature to do it. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong. I do agree that we are premature about it.
Mm. So they're playing Reading when the 28th? Is that a weekend?
Yeah, that's the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 4-game set.
I'm going to come up for one of those games. I think I'm going to drive.
Should.
Yeah, I think that'll be fun. So I'll have to do that. But
that's a lot of talent on the field.
Yeah. I mean, how about how fast they've done that as an organization? I think we've touched on this a little bit, but man, that's impressive how quickly the Twins just added a ton of talent in what, a year and a half.
Yeah, and with bringing in Cole Stewart and with the way that Buxton has developed in the top prospect into the game and the way Sano has blossomed into an easy top 10 guy, maybe even a top 5 guy, with the trades that you know brought in Meyer in May and this draft, and you know the fact that Rosario is playing well, I mean, coupled with the fact that you know the Cardinals have seen a lot of promotion with Waka and Miller, and you know Martinez got a cup, and you know, you really have Tavares and Wong and Jenkins at the minor league level, that I think that you can make a pretty convincing case that the Minnesota Twins have the top farm system in baseball right now.
They certainly have, in terms of high-end impact guys. I mean, it's got to
They have some depth, too, man. Yeah. I mean, they have some depth with, like, the Nico Goodrums of the world, the Barrioses of the world. I mean,
yeah.
The Twins have some fucking talent, and they have some bat missers, too, which is fucked up.
The one guy that I was disappointed I didn't get to see this weekend who did pitch was Baxendale, because I saw him pitch at Arkansas, and you know, I think he's going to be a big leaguer. I don't know if he's probably not a starter, right? But I mean, he's there. We go, putting him in the reliever box right away. But but you know, I was impressed by his stuff at Arkansas. I saw him in the College World Series last year, and I thought he was pretty good. So
absolutely, I agree with you.
So, all right. So, what are you going to do this week?
I am flying to Atlanta
Friday
for the Baseball Prospectus Festival at Turner Field.
The Bonnaroo of Baseball Prospectus.
So,
does this mean you won't shower?
No, I'm not going to shower at all. Tons
That'll
of weed and tons of ween. That's what I'll be doing. What are you doing?
I leave for Omaha. Yeah, I'm leaving for Kendall Fest.
Sweet Tea Festival.
Sweet Tea Festival, right. 8 days with Kendall Rogers. That should be a lot of fun. No, I'm on my way to the College World Series, so get into Omaha. I've got like a 6 a.m. flight tomorrow, and then I'm going to spend we're doing a bunch of shows there on the College Channel on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then I'm going to spend a couple of days after that going to the games and yeah, just hanging out and enjoying some amateur baseball, watching a little ping ball. So, and then come back home for a couple weeks until the All-Star game. So,
well, bring your A&M class ring and bring a jug of sweet tea and bring a bunch of bullshit dad stories, and you'll fit right in with Kendall.
I'm going out to dinner with him on Thursday night, and I'm just looking forward to ripping on him the entire time. So.
When we were in Jupiter for the Perfect Game Showcase, we went out to dinner, and he ordered chili as an appetizer.
All right.
I just looked at him, and I was like, you fuck.
Oh, man. What a piece of work. Yeah, so that's what I'm going to be doing. So next week we'll be recording the show. I'll be in Omaha. Well, we're doing that from the... I don't know, whatever hotel they have me staying in.
Cool.
So, which will be fun. So,
yeah, it's good.
All right, that's going to do it for us. Again, thank you very much to our sponsor this month, Intrepid Inspections. Go to intrepidinspections.com for the same high-level thought and process to insurance inspections that Baseball Prospectus brings to baseball. Music on the way out from the Bench Mob, three of the Mississippi State University baseball players rapping. It's a fun way to conclude it. Have a safe trip to Atlanta. I'll talk to you next week. Later, Peaches.
Later, Herb.
Bow, bow. Bang, bang. Bench Mob. Turn up. It's the Bench Mob. Ready, tat, tat. The Bench Mob. Bow, bow. Bang, bang. It's the Bench Mob. Ready, tat, tat. The Bench Mob. Bow, bow. Bang, bang. It's the Bench Mob. Ready, tat, tat. The Bench Mob. It's the Slim Hansen. Your boy, no punch. You ain't scared of me. It's Slim Hansen, the captain of the Bench Mob. Pass me the mic like LeBron to Wade with the lob. We in your dome, all up in your dome. Got you running home, crying to your mom. It's a 3-2-1 count, and we tickling our gooch. Pulling our team through whenever we got two. If you're part of the Bench Mob, let me hear you say scoot. We jumping all over y'all, yeah, we call that
oops.
We leaving it up, ha. Leaving it for them birds, ha. We leaving it down, down there for them worms. Whether it's the freestyle three or the seventh inning sit, that walk-off walk or that Friday free hit,
yeah.
We'll make our presence heard, ha. We'll make our presence known,
yeah.
Shoot, I think we're the ones who deserve the dog bone. Let me tell you again, Bench Mob. Yeah, double B, a.k.a. I'ma take a walk. Don't follow me.
It's the Bench Mob. Ready, tat, tat. The Bench Mob. Bow, bow, bang, bang. It's the Bench Mob. Ready, tat, tat. The Bench Mob. Bow, bow, bang, bang. It's the Bench Mob. Ready, tat, tat. The Bench Mob. Bow, bow, bang, bang. It's the Bench Mob. Ready, tat, tat. The Bench Mob.
Big Sean is my name. You know I rep that team. We just doing this for fun and flowing on this dream.
Yep.
The mob staying fresh, fresh like a garden. Got that T-Fizz beard. Calling James Harden, staying steady. Steady on this grind. Hit the seventh inning and we ride the pine. Talk a little top, but you know we back it up. Just check the jumbotron and you know what's up.
Yep.
We hit them low, we hit them high. Got my goons on deck, ready to ride. Hit them with that standoff and junkin' on the jug. The lounge yells our name and we show them some love.
Woo!
Bench Mob the team, always saying thirsty, saying bros for life. Ha, I know you heard me, so you come to the field to watch the game. Just remember, Bench Mob is the reason you came.
It's the Bench Mob. Ready, tat, tat. The Bench Mob.
James Easy, but nah, that's me. my name. Whoop. I'm lurking with my squad, and no, we can't be tanked. It's your boy, Easy E, always loyal to the mob. Catch me in the outfield with that home run rhyme. Ha. Chicks dig the long ball, no, not really. In reality, chicks dig the bench mob, you feel me?
Yep.
We hitting the strikes and taking the balls. After a double, we hit on with that trust ball. We gon' grind, we gon' fight. We gon' do this for our brothers. Yeah, we just hit a home run. And here comes another, you know it's the mob. With the second, be silent. If you're scared, go to church, cause we about the violence. Yeah, I love the bench. Yeah, I call him my crew. Yeah, I swag so sick, look like we caught the flu. You say you ain't fair till you got each other's back, but we hit you with the trust fall. What you know about that?
Bow, 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 bow.
Your boy Slim Hawkins, a.k.a. No Pun. Big Chunk, a.k.a. Chunky. Easy E. Don't talk about it, be about it. We're gonna have our cake, and we're gonna eat it too. I told you once, boy, you ain't scared me.
Dope bitch you ever heard.
That's a wrap.